Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in and listening to us. We have a very interesting topic today, one that's dear to my heart because a friend of mine has been in this situation before, and that is preventive cardiology for women. Men and women don't always experience the same things cardiology-wise, so we're going to hear from one of our local experts, not actually local, national too, I would say. Today in the studio with me, I have Dr. Jason Reingold. Welcome, Dr. Reingold.
Thanks, Tanya.
Very good. And let me tell you a little bit about him. He's born not here, but pretty much raised his whole life in Sandy Springs. So we always like to hear about a local expert staying here in our town and lending their talents. Went to medical school at Emory. Did his internal medicine residency at University of California at the San Francisco Medical Center, and then did cardiology fellowship at Mass General Hospital, so a great pedigree, and has served at the St. Joe's Hospital, probably most recently here in Atlanta, is that correct?
Yes.
And focused a lot of your talents in the research area.
Yes.
Very good. So welcome.
Well, thank you guys again, and it's great to be here to talk about something so passionate.
Yes, it is.
For all of us.
It is. I'll tell you, the reason it's dear to my heart is a friend of mine had a cardiac incident. She was the picture of health, had a great diet, was physically fit, and ended up one day having a symptom, and about 2 days later ended up with a bunch of stents, and it shocked everyone. And her symptoms weren't the same. So I want to get some of our stories together and some basic information out there because I think it is kind of different for men and women. So let's start talking about that today. One of the things that surprised me when I was doing the research is I thought that heart disease was going to be much lower on the list of problems for women behind cancer. When we see what is the leading cause of death in women, I think most people would answer cancer, but it's actually heart disease.
Right, and that's one of the things that we're trying to help educate women. Cardiovascular disease kills more women than the next three causes of death combined, including all forms of cancer. And unfortunately, every minute in the United States, a mother, a daughter, a sister, or a friend will die from some form of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, I also read that first incidents for women can be a lot more severe and fatal than in men. So just the very first time can just...
Right. The problem is that in women, heart disease is really the silent killer. And in fact, 2 out of 3 women will die suddenly without any previous symptoms. And that's why it's so important to be here today to raise awareness and to talk about how we can prevent, you know, the women in your audience from becoming another statistic.
Right. So let's start off. We've certainly heard about heart disease in men and women for years, and we certainly know some of the risk factors like smoking and things like that. But let's just dive a little deeper and talk about some of the risk factors that are well known and some that maybe people don't think so much.
I think that's a great way. There's a lot of the conventional risk factors that we all grew up talking about: age, blood pressure, cholesterol, smoking, family history. But we've learned now that the face of heart disease is changing. We know that heart disease is killing younger people. And part of that is due to new risk factors. So what I'd like to do is just tell your viewers about some of the high risk factors that people may not realize. For example, people who have kidney disease, that's a high risk factor for heart disease. People who have diabetes, and people who have other forms of cardiovascular disease like blockages in their legs or blockages in their neck.
Like thrombosis?
Or, yeah, peripheral vascular disease or strokes or carotid disease. Those are all high-risk markers. And then other new risk factors that put patients at risk are things that may have happened during your pregnancy. So if you've had preeclampsia, hypertension during pregnancy, or diabetes, those are all things that put you at risk for heart disease. Another big area for new risk factors is having what we call the autoimmune diseases or collagen vascular diseases. So patients who have rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, any of those inflammatory conditions are at risk for heart disease. And then we know that our population is changing. We know we're all having issues getting time to exercise. We're feeling more stressed. You know, we're having more sadness in our life. We're having problems with maintaining a healthy weight. Those are all risk factors that put women and men at risk. And the problem is these new risk factors are usually or may not be identified by both the patients and physicians. Mm-hmm. So really what we need to do is help empower patients to understand what are these new risk factors.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to a couple of them. First one I want to go back to is family history. So I know we've all had patients that we've seen that seem like the picture of health. They're 45 years old. Somebody has a heart attack and keels over. So to what degree should we take our family history's importance or even know? Some people don't even know their family history because events happened when they were a kid or something. Can you speak, and women in particular, can you speak about family history?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. We're learning that family history is more and more important. And while we say, you know, what happens in your parents is most important, we're now recognizing that things can be in the family that may skip generations. So it's really important to get a full heart history of your siblings, of your first-degree relatives, but even, you know, grandparents, aunts, and uncles. And what we're realizing is that the genetics, the DNA, the genes we inherit from our parents can affect how our body can make plaque or can affect how stable or vulnerable the plaque is. This is a very exciting new area. You know, we're involved in a lot of that research. And the hard part is knowing who are the right patients at this point to get some of the advanced genetic screening for family history.
So what would be, if I asked my mom, you know, what kind of events did you have? What are like some big things that I should pay attention to?
Right. So the first question is you want to get a sense of what age they happened at. So we know that heart disease happens in people. So what we're interested in finding are people who had heart disease early. So maybe they had heart disease in a male under the age of 55, maybe in a female under the age of 65. And what we're asking is, did they have a heart attack? Did they have symptoms of coronary artery disease, chest pain or shortness of breath or other symptoms we'll talk about? But also, do they have risk factors for cardiovascular disease in the family? Hypertension, diabetes, strokes. So it's really a very wide event. And the best thing you can do is give your doctor as much detail as possible. And so for my patients, I specifically ask them, you know, brothers, sisters, mother, father, did anyone have this list of five or six diseases? And then I say, do you know anyone in your family who died suddenly or of unexplained death? I think as we talk more about our grandparents, it's hard to know what exactly they died of.
Because they didn't have the diagnostic things even to be able to know what the event was.
So asking them, do you have unexplained death in your family? That's a really important thing. Asking, you know, did they have a weak heart? So sometimes you have to translate the diseases into more generic terms that our grandparents and great-grandparents may have used.
To kind of trigger our memories.
Exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to also go back to some of these new systemic diseases like the collagen, the disease, the rheumatoid arthritis.
Right.
Is it that because the cardiac specialty is systemic, it goes everywhere in our body, you're finding more links with other kind of systemic type diseases that affect body? So they're cross-linked that way.
It's what we're realizing is inflammation is a key component of developing and rupturing plaques, the basic way heart disease. Think of gook in a pipe.
Okay.
The same things can happen in our linings of our arteries. Mm-hmm. And inflammation, whether it's from rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, can drive that same process.
Is it because of the vasoconstriction?
Well, that could be one component. Yeah, it's the inflammation just sets up, we call it this, you know, just yucky environment mm-hmm. that makes the blood vessels not only constrict, but it also promotes the development of this plaque. And it keeps the plaque what we call vulnerable or not stable. And so then you can have little things that can trigger the rupture. And that's what really leads to the sudden cardiac death mm-hmm. that women often experience. So it's just a better understanding of what heart disease is, and that our knowledge has evolved over the last 10 to 20 years.
Okay. I want to go back to one more before we go on how to manage these risk factors. And that is one that I think in particular around prevention and women is the handling of stress.
Right.
So stress management, I know a lot of times the women are left with the family, the jobs, the health decisions, really kind of everything. And it's something we're really not taught in school or throughout our life is successful stress management. So how much of a factor does that really play?
Well, I think that's a great question.
Prevention.
Yeah, that's a great question. And what we know is that, you know, a lot of women and my wife and my mom, you know, they're sometimes too busy worrying about other people than taking care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And we have to change that. We need, you know, women to take care of themselves. And what's scary is data and surveys have suggested that nearly half of the women don't know to call 911 if they're experiencing symptoms. They will think that it's okay. But if it was their husband to have those same symptoms, they would be calling 911. So we really have to change the attitude about, women do need to take care of themselves. When it then comes to stress and depression, we're learning more and more that those can be things that affect the stability and can promote this rupture of the plaque we're talking about. And so there's actually a syndrome called broken heart syndrome, which we see classically in women who have experienced stressful events, and their heart will literally get weak, and it looks like they have a very severe form of what we call a cardiomyopathy or weak heart.
Can you diagnostically see that?
Testing? Yeah, but they present exactly like a heart attack. They have chest pain. They have shortness of breath. Their EKG looks like they're having acute heart attack. Their cardiac biomarkers look like they're having acute heart attack, and the only way to know is by doing some of these diagnostic tests to rule it out. So stress and the heart is a relationship that we're very interested in studying, and we think it's the same biochemicals that link the brain to the heart can trigger that squeezing
when it's
or
not actually
acute
the heart
rupture.
Itself.
Exactly. So it's a very interesting emerging area, and I, would encourage your viewers to look up the broken heart syndrome. It's really an interesting area and something that women in particular, we see happening.
Very good. So getting back to the healthcare continuum over the life cycle of a woman and some of these newer risk factors that we've been talking about, I know that there's actually, I think, more of a trend on trying to intercept women when they're more likely to be in the doctor. Things like preconceptual counseling or childbearing years or menopause. How would internists that are listening to us, what kind of things should they be screening for at the point that they know they're going to have the women in their office to educate them?
That's another great question. And the scary statistic is that while the overall rate of heart disease in women has been going down, younger women in the age of 30s to 40s are actually having an increased rate of cardiovascular disease. So we are seeing, again, that the face of heart disease is changing. So what we need internists and what we need patients to do is really understand how to classify the risk of women. And the American Heart Association, in conjunction with the American College of Cardiology, has proposed new guidelines to prevent cardiovascular disease in women. And I encourage all women to go to websites like the American Heart Association and internists to get these articles to learn what are the new risk categories. And basically, starting at the age of 25, we should be looking to see, are the women at ideal cardiovascular health, at risk, or at very high risk? And, the website will walk people through what are the at-risk, what are the high-risk, and who's a candidate for being in ideal health. So really it's just asking these questions and saying, what is your cholesterol? What is your blood pressure? What's your blood glucose? How much do you weigh? Are you smoking? How much are you exercising? What's your diet?
Yeah, because I think in general, one of the downfalls we have is we think of, okay, well, I'm generally healthy, but I know once a year I'm going to go in for my pap smear. But I'm thinking, okay, well, my cancer will be fine. I don't think about having a heart check or doing any – I don't even think of my heart when I'm in for my annual woman checkup. But that is a perfect time to intercept somebody that would never have had an event or to check on.
You're right. And in the way medicine is practiced today, OBGYNs and internists are often the first line of defense. They're kind of the gatekeepers who are seeing a lot of women on the front lines. So it's really important that, as physicians, we work with our colleagues to help educate everyone and make sure everyone understands these new guidelines and the new risk assessment for women.
Okay, so during the childbearing years and certainly as we move on through the age, what about hormones and prevention? Any link there with the menopause changes?
Yeah, and I think that's a new great point where, again, our understanding has evolved. So in the past, it's known that estrogen helps prevent heart disease in women, and that's why we've seen that.
Kind of been controversial a little bit.
Yeah, and we know that women have heart disease later than men in general because of estrogen. And so what happens is when your estrogen goes down, your vascular biology changes. It was once thought that we should help prevent heart disease by giving women hormone replacement therapy.
Right.
And that has now been evolved and understands that that actually increases the risk for heart disease. So we don't want that to be a general guiding principle. What you have to do is you have to understand the risk and the balance, the risk and benefit of giving hormone replacement therapy to help women. there are disabling symptoms in menopause, and for certain women, the benefit from hormone replacement therapy can outweigh that risk
right,
of heart disease.
They want to be miserable. They got to sleep every night.
Right. And that's where I would recommend.
I personally understand that, unfortunately.
And yeah. That's why it's so important to see a good preventive cardiologist who can help you understand your risk. And what we try to do is make the patients informed and empowered. We want the women to understand their risk of taking hormone replacement therapy and their risk of having heart disease. And by balancing that risk, we can make informed decisions.
In general, do you feel like the OBGYN provider population is well-versed on educating the women and keeping up?
Well, I think that's where we're, you know, these new guidelines okay. and these outreaches that myself and other physicians right. do are really trying to make a difference. And we encourage our colleagues, whenever they have questions or concerns, to reach out to us.
Right.
But, you know, the fact is they are providing the majority of primary care, so it is important for them to understand that. But we always want to offer our available.
Right. So we've spent quite a bit of time on risk factors. Let's move into what actually, how does a woman experience different cardiac events? So let's kind of talk about, we talked in the green room about the most likely kind of cardiac events a woman might have would be angina, chest pain, heart attack, atrial fib. Why don't you just go through some of those and then maybe talk to us about how women may be the same as men or may be different in what they experience.
So I think the first thing to go over is that when we talk about cardiovascular disease, it's really a big umbrella.
Right.
And the first thing we need to do is try to separate that out. So in general, coronary artery disease, blocked arteries, heart attacks, those are one spectrum of the disease process that, again, we call coronary artery disease. And that's linked to the blockage of blood vessels. But there are a lot of other diseases that affect the heart that women need to be aware of. The next most important one is stroke and atrial fibrillation. We know that women have higher rates of stroke and atrial fibrillation. We know that women aren't getting treated as well as men. So there's, again, a awareness gap and a treatment gap. So if you're a woman and have a stroke, you're more likely to die than a man. If you have atrial fibrillation, you're more likely to have a negative outcome, which is, you know, usually death if you're a woman than a man. Mm-hmm. So that's atrial fibrillation that deals with the heart rhythm. There's also heart muscle issues and valve issues. And we know that women, as they get older, tend to have worse outcomes with leaky or narrowed valves. Mm-hmm. So really there's a whole umbrella, and it's very important that all physicians assess their patients' risk for not only blocked arteries, but the whole spectrum of heart disease.
Yeah, and it can be some things I know, like even just dental work can lead to heart disease, you know, on down the road. So,
and there are certain, you know, conditions we've talked about that there was some research a year or two ago that looked at human papillomavirus.
Yes.
And could that be something specific in women? So it really is a challenge to understand all that's going on with diseases. And what makes this especially difficult for women is that sometimes the symptoms are different than men. Mm-hmm. So we are all used to this, you know, stereotype of our grandfather clutching his chest,
right.
you know, with
left
chest
arm
pain. Exactly.
Yes, left arm pain. We know exactly what it is. They fall over, they clutch their chest, they
right.
have radiating left arm pain. We think of that.
So we talked about, you know, that about 2/3 of women don't even have a symptom. They just have their event. So the second part is the symptoms they have are often more vague and not as specific. So they may have a chest dullness. They may have symptoms related to reflux, shortness of breath. What I commonly see is my practice is as patients get older, their symptoms are fatigue.
Okay.
So it's really difficult on your own to make that diagnosis. And so what we need to encourage our women colleagues to do is, first of all, realize that any symptom needs to be evaluated by a doctor. And second, realize that it's not just chest pain. It's unfortunately a whole bunch of symptoms. Nausea, throwing up, those are all symptoms that we tend to see more in women.
Right.
Than in men.
Think a key point there is that we are not the experts as patients in identifying. In the green room, we were talking about an event that my daughter had at 12 years old, and you said, what happened to her? I said, she came on and said, I'm having chest pain, take me to the hospital, which no 12-year-old says, and it ended up being lung. So we aren't even reliable in an area of identifying. So you just need to take it seriously and pay attention and go get professional
advice. I think that's the most important thing is to empower, you know, women to feel they are at risk for heart disease and they have a right to come to the doctor, mm-hmm. even if it's not, as you talked about, a heart attack. There's still things that we may be able to help prevent their disease process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my patients taught me that lesson. She's a 16-year-old who basically came with chest pain. Nobody thought she was having a heart attack, and she had one of the most severe and rare forms. So it does happen. She got bounced around from hospital to hospital. And so you can't, you know, you can't take it into your own hands. If you have any concerning symptoms, you need to speak to your doctor or seek, you know, medical care.
What is when you see patients for the first time and they come and find you, what is, like, one statistic I remember a friend of mine saying is that in general, women wait way long before when they have a cell. Like, if a man has chest pain, he's in the doctor like tomorrow. A woman's like, oh, it's nothing. So, well, is there like a bigger gap?
Yeah, between? I mean, think about Rosie O'Donnell. Think about what happened to her. She waited. She didn't think she was having a problem. And she was very lucky that she didn't have the complication of sudden cardiac death. So we know that, you know, sometimes you don't get a second chance. When you're having the symptom, you know, you need to call your doctor or seek medical care. And all too often we see patients who wait. And that's when it then turns from a what could be a small heart attack into a big heart attack with lots of complications.
Right.
And so I really encourage all of the listeners, if they're having symptoms, don't wait anymore. Mm. You know, see a specialist who can help you, who's qualified to take care of women with heart disease, and, you know, make sure that you're not becoming, again, another statistic.
Right. So let's back up just a little bit and talk about some symptoms that are not heart attacks. Like, how would I, if I'm a 65-year-old woman, how, and I've been relatively healthy in my checkups, how would I know if I have, like, the beginning of coronary artery disease, or I'm beginning to have a problem?
Well, that's a great question. And the problem is that by the time you have symptoms, you have advanced disease.
Mm-hmm.
So really what we're trying to identify is what we call subclinical disease.
Okay.
And those are, you know, that's where you have the plaque building up in your arteries, and it's not yet at the 80 or 90% blockage that can cause symptoms. Mm-hmm. But you know what's scary? The majority of heart attacks happen in the plaques that are small, that are 30 or 40 or 50%. So there's this big disconnect. We get worried when people have chest pain. We get worried when people get exertional symptoms. But at least they have a warning sign. My bigger concern is the 50-year-olds and the 60-year-olds who don't know that they're at risk.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like a snap, mm-hmm. one of those plaques can rupture.
So
really it's going through these risk factors. It's identifying, are you someone who's at high risk, and making treatment changes.
Mm-hmm.
As a preventive cardiologist, I have certain tools in my bag that can let me look at people's arteries. There are mm-hmm. things called calcium scoring heart scans. There are advanced genetic tests. There are advanced lipid tests. There's all sorts of things we can do. Now, those tests aren't for everyone. There are risks and there are benefits. And again, you need to seek the counsel of a preventive cardiologist to determine what's my risk and are these tests important. What I would encourage all your viewers is, again, figure out what risk category you are and do you need risk refinement. If you're in a low-risk group, do basic heart-healthy things, which we can talk about. If you're in a high-risk group, get treated very aggressively. If you're in that middle intermediate group, that's when a preventive cardiologist can really help you help redefine and reclassify your risk.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the diagnosis. You mentioned your tool of tricks. So let's just kind of go down, because I think people hear everything from, I'll just go over to the hospital and get that little $200 life scan. It'll tell me if my arteries are open. I'm good.
Right.
Up to blood work. I think a lot of people don't understand all that goes in. So what are the basic tools that you have diagnostically to
right.
determine?
Well, the most important thing is honestly the history. So as we talked about, there are simple questions I can ask that can put you in a high-risk group, or certain questions that can put you in a low-risk group. Where we start using the bag of tricks are for patients who are in that intermediary group. They have some things that sound a little funny, but they may still be young. And so it's in those patients that I would talk about using some of these tricks. One example is the heart scan or the calcium score. What that does, it looks at the arteries and determines if there's calcified plaque buildup. That is the precursor, and that is the evidence that there's coronary artery disease.
That's a blood test?
That is a special kind of CAT
image.
Scan.
Okay.
It's a low radiation CAT scan.
Okay.
And again, it's very important before you do that test that you talk to the
mm-hmm.
doctor. It's very important that you go to the right facility, because
you just can't walk in off the street and say, hey, I heard about this on the radio, fellows. I want one.
I think you need to be very careful
right.
because radiation does have risks. But
right.
in patients who are intermediate or at risk for heart disease, that risk could be well worth it. And the benefit in knowing that you have heart disease and that we're going to put you on an appropriate treatment regimen can really be important. The other tests that we use are genetic tests in some patients. So there are certain genetic markers that we know some families have, and we can test younger individuals before the disease becomes symptomatic and determine if that they're at risk.
Like what would be an example?
So probably the most common genetic one that we look for is called 9p21. Mm-hmm. That means on chromosome 9 at segment 21, they have a certain genetic code. We don't necessarily understand what that code does, but we know that in large groups of patients, that's a big risk factor for developing subsequent heart disease. The area of genetics is very new. We're studying how to best use this in clinical practice. So again, you want to do this in conjunction with the doctor.
Provider. Mm-hmm.
And I think the other group are what are some people call additional or advanced lipid testing. We understand that, you know, it's not just about the cholesterol. There's not even good or bad cholesterol, but there's different kinds of very bad cholesterol or different kinds of what we call particle counts or even certain things called ApoB. These are just buzzwords that, mm-hmm. you know, will empower your viewers to bring up with their doctor and do
right.
some investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I want to make the point that these are not tests that should be used for everyone, mm-hmm. and they're tests that need to be done in discussion with mm-hmm. the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But your more common things are everyone by the age of 25 should have had a cholesterol test.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should be screened for diabetes if they're at risk. Everyone should be screened for the metabolic syndrome. So these are all things that if I find them on my exam or history of the patient, that puts them into a certain higher risk group than they may have known. How many people, you know, walk in having heard of the diagnosis of metabolic syndrome? But if I find that, that's almost, in my mind, a, you know, very at-risk patient.
And at what age would, like on a preventive health checkup or annual checkup, an EKG actually show up as part of our annual checkup? Ever?
Yeah, so that's okay. A great question. I think it's something very controversial for your viewers who are, you know, who have children who are in sports. The debate of using EKGs in athletes is very timely. It's a very mm-hmm. hot debate. For people who have family histories, we start to get EKGs earlier on. And it really is driven by the patient's history. So if there's someone who have diabetes, the metabolic syndrome, we will get an EKG for that. But the majority of times, the EKG is driven by patient symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're having chest pain, shortness of breath, fatigue, I'm most certainly going to get an EKG. If they're having nausea, that's, again, where knowing the wide breadth of symptoms, the diverse ways heart disease can present, recognizing that those require getting an EKG is very helpful.
Right.
But in terms of just a should all 25-year-olds get an EKG to screen, we mm-hmm. don't yet have data that mm-hmm. that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I think would be helpful to the listeners is what to expect when they come to visit you. So I've had some event. I talk to my OBGYN. She screens me and says, you know what? I think you should see a cardiologist, and here's why. When I hear chest pain or fatigue, you have more fatigue than whatever. When they come to see you in the prevention mode, no big event yet,
right.
What happens?
So the most important thing, which everyone hates, is filling out the forms.
Right.
So that's the worst part of talking to your doctor. But that's, again, part of the history where
– But it gives a baseline.
It gives a baseline. So I'll be asking about your pregnancy history on the form. I'll be asking if you have symptoms that may be these collagen vascular diseases. I'll be asking if you have – you know, things that may make you predisposed to having diabetes. So I know patients hate those forms, but they're very important. The second component is the actual history, where I'm going to listen to your story. You know, I want you to speak for a few minutes so that I can really understand what's going on. The goal is not for me to come in with a preconceived notion of what you have. It's really for you to tell me what's going on and for that to guide me. The next step is the physical exam. This is where I'm going to look for actually signs of these other diseases. So if I hear abnormal heart sounds, or if I hear, you know, fluid in the lungs, or if I see that your feet have poor pulses, or I hear noises in the blood vessels that go to your brain, those are all going to be tips to me that something is going on with the cardiovascular system. And then there's a basic lab set that we think most patients get. That's your basic cholesterol, you know, some of your basic assessment of your kidney disease, a basic assessment if you have diabetes or insulin resistance. So only after all of those will I then, you know, speak with the patient and say, give them a comprehensive picture of what's going on within their heart. And after that, we will then look and say, do we need some of these additional testing? So I think it's important for patients not to go in expecting, I'm going to get these 10 these 10 tests or these 10 images. We really want to pair the appropriate testing based on the patient's risk. And so the way I practice medicine is trying to understand what the patient's risk is and then saying, here are the things that could help you. What's their benefit and what's their risk? So I really try to do personalized and innovative diagnostic and treatment options that are really tailored to the patient. Mm-hmm. This is the new way of, I think, medicine's being done.
Personalized medicine,
mm-hmm. innovative medicine. It's, you know, everyone's situation is a bit different. And as we talked about, if we just go with the facts, you know, and say, oh, you're a young woman who's fatigued, you're just stressed, we're going to miss out mm-hmm. on detecting disease. So mm-hmm. it's really important to find a doctor who's going to do this comprehensive evaluation.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'd like to go through just for the benefit of patients listening to us is I think sometimes they get confused about the testing. Like, for example, I've known women that put off going to see a cardiology preventively because they think I can never get on a treadmill and do a stress test. So if he's going to ask me to do that, I just won't go and hopefully everything will work out fine. I don't think they even realize that there's another way to see how you handle the stress chemically. Can you kind of just walk through on a graduated basis, like an EKG, what to expect, how long it takes, a stress test, a cath? A lot of people very concerned about, I don't want to have, you know, they hear their friend stories, they don't understand. So maybe just some of the three or four big kinds of tests you could distinguish for the listeners.
Well, I think those are, you know, great to identify what are barriers mm-hmm. to patients getting the care they need. So we definitely want to go over them and try to eliminate them. So I think the most important thing is that we have lots of flexibility and we have lots of different options. So, again, when patients come in and say, you know, I can't run on a treadmill or my friend had this test, I can go through with them lots of different options. Mm-hmm. And, again, different cardiologists have different set of tricks, and it's important to find someone who can offer the full spectrum. Mm-hmm. I think the basic tests are the EKG. It's painless. Actually, for men, it's not painless because it rips off the chest hair. So I think that's one where the men do men have it worse than women. But you know, the EKG is about 5 seconds. It really helps us understand the rhythm of the heart, and it is the initial test for anyone who's having symptoms, whether it's palpitations,
like your main
chest pain,
bread and butter marker of heart function.
Now, remember, the problem with that is that tells us kind of the electrical activity of the heart mm-hmm. at that moment. What we find is that when a lot of people are having symptoms, the EKG machine's not on them. So we don't capture the events as they're happening. Mm-hmm. What we then do is move to, if a woman's saying, I'm having symptoms, that's where we move to stress testing. And what we try to do is we try to say, if you're someone who's, you know, a low risk or low to intermediate, you're going to get this stress test. If you're someone who's intermediate, you get this kind of stress test. If you're someone who's high risk, we may not need a stress test because we know you're high risk. Mm-hmm. The best type of stress test is an exercise test where you can actually do activity because that's seeing physiologically what your body mm-hmm. does. And I've noticed that a lot of people, as they get older, have problems running on the treadmill. Mm-hmm. So one technology that I brought from the New England where I train was we do a bike stress test. So people are lying on a flat bicycle.
It's a little more fluid and not so hard on the joints.
Yeah, so it's not as hard on the joints. A lot of elder women have balance issues and are scared of running on the treadmill. Mm-hmm. So on the bicycle, they're lying there, so nothing can happen. So we actually think that, you know, we have certain techniques that we can fit the whole mm-hmm. spectrum of people. Now, there still are some people who can't do enough activity, mm-hmm. and that's when you move to what we call a chemical or drug-induced stress test. We like those less because, again, they're not physiologic, but they are still important in some cases.
Because it'll show how they respond. It's better than not knowing.
It's better than not knowing. And what you'll notice is a few years ago, women and men had to go through this horrible 5-minute test. They'll remember the injection was 5 minutes, and they would literally feel like their heart stopped. Mm-hmm. And they would feel flushing, crushing sternal chest pain. That test has now been changed so that it can be done in 1 minute. So I have a lot of women who say, I don't want that test I had 5 years ago. I thought I was going to die. And again, it's my job and doctor's job to educate and empower mm-hmm. patients to understand there are new options. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of catheterizations unless a patient's having what we call an acute coronary syndrome. So we have technology called cardiac CTs where we can do a non-invasive angiogram. on the patient if they're the right risk. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where you're going to see, that's where the emerging technology is helping.
Less and less invasive.
Less
for
and less
all
invasive,
different kinds.
For all invasive. And even for patients who need a catheterization, we can now do them in the wrists instead of the legs. So the main point is don't let your fears overtake mm-hmm. you. Ignorance is not bliss. Mm-hmm. Heart disease is not going to go away.
You.
So, you know, come again to a doctor who has the experience and can offer a plethora of tests and will work with you. But, you know, it is that's the fear gap that is mm-hmm. a big barrier.
And it holds a lot of people back. You hate to hear the stories when you
right.
know in retrospect somebody could have gone and then they end up having an event.
And many of my patients, they all say, well, that wasn't that bad. You know,
right,
so,
yeah.
So we have a lot of anticipation.
We live with the fear.
Exactly.
Yeah, we live with it. Yeah.
So I would encourage everyone to give it one try.
Right. So in the spirit of prevention, let's distinguish a little bit between primary and secondary prevention.
Great. So primary prevention is the idea that we're going to pick up disease before it happens. It just makes common sense. Why wait to, you know, start lowering your cholesterol until you have a heart attack? And this is launched a new field of what we call preventive cardiology. So the idea here is we're taking people who are at risk before they have the event and offering lifestyle changes as well as medication changes. Secondary prevention refers to someone who already had events. And in that situation, you know,
you're improving.
We're trying to improve and keep them from having another event. Mm-hmm. So both of those have led to this new field of preventive cardiology, and really we're addressing, you know, trying to address both sides. They're both very important. But I think where a lot of your listeners are interested is that primary prevention. Mm-hmm. How do I keep?
I never want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. And again, we can affect change. If you know, we can be proactive. We don't have to live by our genetic code. We can affect changes. And for primary prevention, there's very simple things you can do. Little things make a difference.
So what are the top three?
I think the top three is, regardless of primary or secondary, stop smoking. Smoking in women is especially dangerous. And women who smoke die twice as much of sudden cardiac death than women who don't smoke. The second is becoming more physically active. So as little as 30 minutes every day, low intensity, just walking around your building or walking around the mall is very helpful. And then adopting a more what we call Mediterranean or mm-hmm. DASH-like diet. Mm-hmm. So those are all simple things that all of us, whether we're 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s, mm-hmm. can do.
It's good life habits.
It's good life habits. Once you have an event, once you have a heart attack or a stroke, you're considered at risk. We then need to manage your goals much more tightly. So it's more difficult to just get your cholesterol down without a medicine. You have to put more effort into physical activity. Your diet has to be more restricted. So what's nice is if we can get you a primary prevention, the lifestyle changes are actually easier. If you wait till secondary prevention, sometimes it's harder. So think about the dentist. No one wants to go to the dentist. If you go twice a year and get regular cleanings, it's much better than having that root canal and the drill in the root canal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the analogy. A little pain in the beginning, you know, mm-hmm. go see a doctor. I know it's not fun, can save you from a lot worse pain.
Yeah. The other thing I really honed in on when you were speaking was that it doesn't have to be dramatic changes. You don't have to change everything you eat. You just have to make more consistent choices in the right thing, or even just a little bit of walking.
Yes.
Not doing Zumba three times a week or something will make a difference in your cardiac health.
That's a huge change in understanding and a big awareness gap that patients still have. Yeah. So I don't think people recognize that just losing a few pounds will make a huge effect on your blood pressure. I have some patients who, just by losing a few pounds and walking at the mall, were able to get off medications.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in primary prevention, little can go a long way.
Yeah, very good.
And that's the key message, is just eating a few more fruits and vegetables, cutting down on even sodas, can drop your weight enough mm-hmm. so that you don't have
or
to be on blood
pressure.
Eating
less red meat in a week, or
yeah,
the littlest things.
There's all sorts of little things. And again, go to the American Heart Association website and learn what little things you can do can make a very big difference.
Very good. I want to talk briefly. I know you spent quite a bit of time at St. Joe's in the research area. So could you just tell us about some new promising things in your field that are kind of coming our way, what you're excited about?
Yeah, there's so much to be excited for in both the diagnosis and treatment of heart disease in both men and women. And, you know, a lot of institutions in Atlanta are working on these research initiatives. So I think the first thing is fundamentally changing how we diagnose heart disease. So we're understanding that the running the stress test is not the best test for a lot of situations. And we all know that Tim Russert, you know, did his stress test and then dropped dead the next day. So we're learning what are new ways. And I think the cardiac CT, the heart scan or the non-invasive angiogram is going to be a hugely important way to diagnose what we call non-obstructive disease. So that's disease that's a 20% blockage, a 30% blockage, these things that we used to ignore. We now know that that's a great way to intervene and that those are the most important patients to treat before they develop the event. In terms of treatment, we're learning that there are all sorts of new options for patients who have what we call non-obstructive coronary artery disease. This was also used to be called vasospasm or syndrome X. So these are women who have, you know, severe symptoms, chest pain, shortness of breath, but when they do their catheterizations, they don't have the big blockages that typically men have. So this is a whole new area where there are new medications that we're learning how to use for women. Now, some people may have said the women don't have disease. That's wrong. We know that these women who have what we call non-obstructive coronary artery disease or vasospasms or syndrome X or endothelial dysfunction actually are 2 and 3 times risk of women who don't. So again, don't think that just because you have a normal catheterization or a normal stress test that you're well, that
you're
don't have
free.
Heart disease, right. And so now we have treatment options to help women who are suffering from these debilitating symptoms. And I think that the next category are, you know, women who have atrial fibrillation and have been told you're not a good candidate for Coumadin or we can't get your blood thinned. We now have a whole new class of medications that are maybe safer than Coumadin and work better. So again, there was a lot of women who weren't being treated with atrial fibrillation to protect them from having a stroke. Now we can intervene on that. So
there's exciting.
There's
hard to keep up sometimes.
It's
the technology changes.
I think I'm involved in 15 or 16, trials right now, and they're all very exciting. And we have even more exciting things for people who have advanced heart disease. But those are just some of the basic research that, if you come to me,
on the
side. We'll look to see, do we have better ways to diagnose your heart disease? And it's great because by participating in research, patients don't have to bear some of the financial costs that these new tests have. And they're looked over very closely. They have a study nurse who works with them. So I sometimes joke that my research patients actually get better care.
They probably get more attention.
They get definitely more attention.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, I think sometimes we were talking before about how I think listeners remember a story that rings true. So today we're talking about preventive cardiology in women and the younger face of women that have heart disease. Is there any patient story that sticks out in your mind that kind of, you told us one about the 20-year-old that just kind of looks at first glance like it shouldn't have been a problem, but people should have paid attention? Or
I think I have to go back to, one of my favorite patients who I've gone very closely, the high school student who had, what was ultimately a spontaneous coronary artery dissection. Again, a very rare condition, and I don't want anyone to focus on that. But the idea is that, she was not aware that she's having heart disease. The physicians who took care of her were not aware that she could be at risk. And again, we missed that opportunity, and she had some unfortunate, issues happen to her. So I think, again, don't make the decision yourself. Try to get to a doctor. And the sad part is all of us, again, we know wives, mothers, daughters, sisters. You don't need my stories. Every viewer, unfortunately, is going to have a story because heart disease is so prevalent in women. So I would actually ask your listeners to think about the women in their life who have been affected by heart disease. And, I'm very lucky in that I get to help and work with women and men. And, every day I have lots of stories.
But we'll have you back to talk about them on another day. Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of
separate
issues.
Stories.
Yeah, a lot of great stories there. Well, believe it or not, we're at the end of our time together. I really appreciate you being here today. And before you leave us, I want to let the patients know how they can get a hold of you. So you have Twitter. They can follow you on Twitter. Do you want to let them know?
Yeah, it's very simple, Dr. Jason Reingold. So that's a Twitter, Facebook, and we have a website, www.drjasonreingold.com. So it's drjasonreingold.com. reingold.com, and we have a phone number, which is 404-436-1819, and that's our office voicemail. We're excited about launching the new practice. It's hopefully coming up in the next couple of weeks, so I would encourage any listeners to check our website, check our Twitter for updates, and I wanted to thank everyone for the opportunity to speak on a topic that I'm very passionate about. And
we can tell. Thank you so much for being here. We'll have you back on the men's side in very short order, hopefully.
Great.
To the listeners out there, thank you for listening today. I want to put a shout out for a couple of things. One is across my desk this week came an urgent plea from the Red Cross. Apparently, there is a national shortage of blood right now in the summer. They've put out emergency requests. So please, if you're in any position, go on site to the Red Cross, and you can find a place where you can donate very quickly. And I know that they're around town a lot in the next couple of weeks. Also, too, please visit our sponsor at healthgate.com to find how you might find savings offers for you if you're in a position where you're paying for out-of-pocket. And do listen, we are now broadcasting live on Business Radio X on our own HealthGate channel. So not just on Thursdays, but you can dial in 24/7 and catch Dr. Reingold or any of our other guests again. So thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.